Chapter 5. Zanzibar. For the next hour they sat on the afterdeck, sipping ice-cold water and enjoying the gentle rocking of the Andreal and listening to the waves lapping at the hull. Within the first 30 minutes of the Yulin's departure, it appeared twice more, a mile out, cruising first north to south, then south to north. It had not returned. "Can't help but worry the bells tumbled over the edge," Remy said. "I can see it in my mind's eye." "Me too, but I'd rather risk that than have them come back while we're in the middle of raising it. Let's give it another 20 minutes. Worst case, we can probably still get to it." "True, but at 150 feet, things start getting dicey. Getting down there wouldn't be so hard. Finding it might be." As massive as the bell was, after bouncing down a 150-foot slope, it could end up almost anywhere, like a dropped child's marble that's lost in the dining room but ends up under the refrigerator in the kitchen. And once we find it, getting it up to the surface is a different can of worms altogether. Better dive gear, compressor, lift bags, winch. Sam was nodding. There would be no chance of hiding that level of activity from curious or prying eyes. Simply renting the equipment in Stonetown, even anonymously, would set the rumor mill in motion. By day's end, there would be onlookers both on the shoreline and in boats offshore, including, perhaps, the Yulin gunboat and her mysterious passenger. "Let's hope it doesn't come to that," he said. They moved the Andreal to within 30 feet of the bell's location. Sam went over the side and wedged the anchor behind a rock outcropping, and then, back aboard, they uncoiled the 100 feet of solid braided 3/4-inch anchor rope they'd purchased earlier in Stonetown. They looped the rope over the port and starboard rear gunwale cleats, then secured the loop in the center with a screw-linked D-ring. The remainder of the coil they tossed over the stern. 2 minutes later, they were in their snorkel gear and finning along the surface, dragging the rope behind them. To their mutual surprise, they found the bell where they'd left it, perched on the edge of the precipice, but they immediately found the situation was more precarious than they'd anticipated. The sand beneath the bell's mouth was eroding before their eyes, wisps of sand and chunks of rock being ripped away by the current. Remy fed the end of the rope through the D-ring on her dive belt, then handed it to Sam, who did the same, then clamped the rope's screw-length D-ring between his teeth. They finned to the surface, grabbed a half-dozen lungfuls of air, then dove again. Sam signaled to Remy, "Pictures." If the worst came to pass and they lost the bell, pictures would at least give them a chance at identification. As Remy started shooting, Sam finned forward until he could see over the edge. The slope was not quite vertical, but rather 60 or 65 degrees. Not that it mattered. As Remy had earlier guessed, the bell's weight surpassed that of the speakers by 20 or 30 pounds. If the bell decided to go over the edge, the slope's angle would slow its descent only slightly. And then, as if on cue, the sand beneath the bell gave way. The crown tipped upward, hovered for a split second, then the bell began sliding, mouth first, down the slope. On an impulse he immediately regretted, Sam coiled his legs, gave a sharp dolphin kick, and followed the bell over the edge. He heard fleetingly Remy's muffled scream of "Sam!" and then it was gone, replaced by the rush of the current. Sand peppered his body like 1,000 bee stings. Tumbling now head over feet, Sam reached out in what he hoped was the direction of the bank. The outstretched fingers of his right hand struck something hard, and he felt a sharp pain shoot through his pinky finger. Ignoring the pain, he could feel the bell picking up speed now, the bulldozer-like effect of the mouth losing to the physics of momentum. His eyesight began to swim as his lungs began consuming the last molecules of oxygen. His heart pounded in his head like cannon fire. Working from feel alone, he slid his hand up the bell's waist, then over the head. His fingers found the opening of the crown. He lifted his left hand up to its mouth, grabbed the D-ring, and fed it through the crown. He curled it around the line and then, using his thumb, spun the screw link closed. The bell jerked to a stop. The rope let out a muffled twang. Sam lost his grip and he began sliding downward, hands slapping at the bell's surface, fingers scrabbling for purchase. There was nothing. Then suddenly a ridge slid beneath his palm. He felt another stab of pain in his pinky finger. The bead line, he thought. His curled fingertips had landed on the bead line just above the mouth of the bell. He reached up with his other hand, gripped the line, then chinned himself upward, both legs kicking against the draw of the current until the anchor line came into view, a braid of pure white in the swirl of sand. He grabbed it. He felt fingers touch the back of his hand. Out of the gloom, a face appeared. Remy. His eyesight was sparkling now and dimming at the edges. Remy pulled herself down the anchor line, reached down, clamped onto his right wrist, and tugged. Instinctively, Sam latched onto the rope and began climbing. 10 minutes later, he sat in the deck chair, eyes closed and head tilted back into the sun. After 2 minutes of this, he brought his head level again and opened his eyes to find Remy sitting on the gunwale watching him. She leaned forward and handed him a bottle of water. "Feeling better?" she asked gently. "Yes. Much. Pinky fingers jammed, though. Smarts." He held it up for inspection. The digit was straight but swollen. He curled it and winced. "It's not broken. Nothing a little athletic tape won't cure." "Nothing else wrong?" Sam shook his head.
"Good. Glad to hear it," said Remy.
"Sam Fargo, you're a dummy."
"Pardon me?"
"What were you thinking, going after that thing?"
"I just reacted. By the time I realized what the hell I was doing, it was too late. In for a penny, in for..."
"A one-way trip to the bottom of the ocean," Remy countered with a scowling shake of her head.
"I swear, Fargo."
"Sorry," Sam said. "And thanks for coming to get me."
"Dummy," Remy repeated, then got up, walked over, and kissed him on the cheek.
"But you're my dummy, and you don't need to thank me.
But you're welcome anyway."
"Tell me we still have it," Sam said, looking around. "Do we still have it?" He was still a tad woozy. Remy pointed off the stern where the anchor line, taut as piano wire, arced down into the water. "While you were taking your catnap, I dragged it off the slope. It should be resting about 5 feet from the edge."
"Nicely done."
"Don't get too excited. We still have to raise it."
Sam smiled.
"Have no fear, Remy.
Physics is our friend."
Before they could apply Sam's idea, however, they had to exercise some brute force. With Sam's newly damaged pinky wrapped in duct tape, he stood in the stern ticking up slack in the anchor line while Remy reversed the Andreal's engine and followed his hand signals until they were almost directly above the bell. He uncoiled the line from the cleats, took up the remainder of the slack, then looped and locked down again. Sam called, "All ahead slow, nice and easy."
"You got it."
Remy eased the throttle forward a quarter inch at a time. Sam, leaning over the stern, his face mask in the water, watched the bell's progress as it bulldozed through the sand. When it was 20 feet from the edge of the precipice, he called, "All stop!" Remy throttled down. Sam settled the mask over his face and dove down to examine their prize. He resurfaced a minute later.
"Looks good. Not much barnacle growth, which means it's probably been embedded in that bank for quite a while."
Remy extended her hand and helped Sam aboard. She asked,
"Damage?"
"None that I could see."
"It's thick, Remy. Probably closer to 80 pounds. She whistled softly.
"Big boy."
"Okay, by standard measure, that'd make the ship...
what,
1,000 tons displacement?"
"Between that and 1,200. Much bigger than the speaker. The proximity of the Adelaide's coin and the bell is pure coincidence."
With the bell no longer in danger of dropping into the channel, they disconnected and steered the Andreal north 100 yards, then eased their way through the inlet at the island's ankle and emerged in the Stiletto Lagoon. Only a half mile wide and long, the lagoon was actually a mangrove swamp. Jutting from the water were a couple dozen floating islands, mushroom caps of earth sitting atop buttresses of exposed, gnarled mangrove roots. Ranging in size from standing room only to a double garage, all were covered in thick weeds, and most supported miniature forests of scrub trees and bushes. At the southern end of the swamp was a narrow beach, and beyond that a copse of coconut palms. It was eerily quiet, the air dead still. "Now this isn't something you see every day," Remy murmured. "Any sign of the Mad Hatter or Alice?" "No, knock wood." "Let's get moving. Daylight's burning." They made their way through the floating islands, dropped anchor just off the beach, and waded ashore. "How many are we going to need?" Remy asked. With one hand, she deftly curled her auburn hair off her neck and snapped a rubber band around it, making a neat topknot. Sam smiled. "It's like magic how you do that." "We are a wondrous species," Remy agreed with a smile and wrung the water from her shirt tails. "So, how many?"
"Six. No, five."
"And you're sure we couldn't get what we need in Stone Town and sneak back here?"
"You want to risk it? Something tells me that gunboat captain would be only too happy to arrest us. If he thinks we were lying to him..."
"True."
"Okay, Gilligan. Let's make your raft."
They had no trouble finding plenty of downed trees, but a harder time finding ones of a manageable size. Sam identified five candidates, all roughly 8 feet long and about as big around as a telephone pole. He and Remy dragged each log down to the beach, where they arranged them in a row. Sam went to work. The construction was simple enough, Sam explained. He grabbed a nearby piece of driftwood and inscribed the plan in the sand.
"Not exactly the Queen Mary," Remy observed with a smile.
"For that," Sam replied, "I'd need at least 4 more logs.
"Why the protruding ends?"
"Two reasons. Stability and leverage."
"For what?"
"You'll see. Right now, I need some line, a few dozen 6-foot lengths. Remy saluted.
"As you command."
After an hour's work, Sam straightened up and stared at his creation. His narrowed eyes told Remy her husband was running equations in his head. After a minute of this, Sam nodded.
"Okay. Should be buoyant enough," he proclaimed, "with about 20% in reserve."
With the raft in tow, they slipped back through the inlet to the island's western side and headed south along the coast until they were again over the Bell's resting place. Using the gaff hook, Sam maneuvered the raft around to the landward side of the Andreal and secured it to the cleats.
"My gut tells me we're due for another drive-by," Sam said, sitting down in a deck chair.
Remy joined him, and together they drank water and watched the water until, 30 minutes later, the Yulin appeared to the north, a half mile out.
"Good call," Remy said.
The Yulin slowed to a walking pace, and from their afterdeck Sam and Remy could see a figure in a white uniform standing on its afterdeck. Sun glinted off binocular lenses.
"Smile and wave," Sam said.
Together they did just that until the figure lowered its binoculars and disappeared into the cabin. The Yulin came about and began heading north. Sam and Remy waited until it disappeared around the curve of the island, then went back to work. With the already prepped anchor in one hand, Sam donned his fins and mask and rolled over the side. After a bit of wrangling, he centered the raft over the bell. He knotted the end of the anchor line to the far side of the raft, dove at an angle until the line was taut, then jammed the anchor's flukes into the sand. Back on the surface, he caught the line Remy tossed to him, then looped it over the raft's center beam, dove down, and clamped the D-ring onto the bell's crown.
A minute later, he was back on the afterdeck, where he secured Remy's line to both cleats. Hands on his hips, he appraised the setup. Remy smiled sideways at him.
You're very pleased with yourself, aren't you?
I am.
You should be, my intrepid engineer.
Sam clapped his hands together once. Let's do this. With Remy at the wheel, Sam called, Slow ahead!
Slow ahead, Remy repeated.
The water beneath the stern turned to froth, and the Andreal eased forward a foot, then two. The cleated line began rising from the water. With a muffled squelch pop, the rope cinched down on the raft's crossbeam.
Looking good, Sam called. Keep going!
The raft began moving, closing the distance to the stern.
Come on, Sam muttered. Come on.
On the far side of the raft, the anchor line quivered with tension as it negated the Andreal's drag on the raft. Sam donned his mask, bent over the side, and stuck his face in the water. 12 feet below, the bell was hovering a few inches off the bottom. Remy called, How are we doing?
A thing of beauty. Keep going.
One careful foot at a time, they lifted the bell until finally the crown broke the surface and thunked into the crossbeam.
Slow to idle, Sam ordered. Just enough to hold position.
Idling, Remy replied. Sam grabbed the 6-foot length of line from the deck and dove over the side. 3 strokes brought him to the raft. 5 loops through the bell's crown and a bowline knot over the crossbeam, and the bell was secure. Sam lifted his hands triumphantly, like a cowboy who'd just roped a calf.
Done, he called.
The Andreal's engines sputtered and went silent. Remy walked onto the afterdeck, smiled, and returned her husband's thumbs up.
Congratulations, Fargo, she called. Now what?
Sam's smile dropped away.
Not sure. Still working it out.
How did I know you were going to say that?